Questions. They have plagued humanity from the dawn of our ancestors to each of us breathing on this earth today. The only thing more important than answering what questions we can is keeping them a secret. Join me, a random average Joe, on a journey to uncover answers which ail us in each of our own way. Such as, what happens when the sky goes teal instead of orange at a sunset? Welcome to the Joe Van Secret Podcast. This is episode 24. With me today is guest 23. Guest 23, please say hello.
Hello.
So I don't know if you know the full concept of this podcast, but the identity of each guest is a secret, and I keep it that way. So for all intents and purposes, you could be a teenage girl or, you know, absolutely anybody. So
hello.
Yeah, you can like make up a whole fake life or you can be honest. It's totally up to you. So before we get into it, I got the fun facts of the day, just to start things off. So the first one here, this is like a mini fact. It's only interesting to some. The save icon on Microsoft Word shows a floppy disk with the shutter on backwards. That's something that I'm sure nobody in today's world would notice. Another one here is firehouses have circular stairways originating from the old days when the engines were pulled by horses. The horses learned how to walk up straight staircases, so they made them spiral. And the last one here is when possums are playing possum, or dead, they aren't actually playing. They pass out from sheer terror. It's kind of a bad defense mechanism, but there you go. Okay, so on to our guest. I'll start by asking, how was your day today?
I'm having a lovely day.
Awesome. Is anything noteworthy, or is it just one of those average days?
I am enjoying the winter, and yeah, a little bit of dusting of snow, and the Christmas season is coming, and I enjoy all that very much.
Very good. Yeah, I guess the snow is landing, and it's sticking. What do they say? It's going to be 5 to 10 centimeters?
I haven't checked.
Yeah, but either way, yeah, winter is definitely here. Yeah, the weather itself is just interesting. I mean, you know, it's getting like more and more extreme, or it's, you know, everything's off season.
I agree.
It's interesting times we live in. So on to the next question. And this one could be long-winded. It's totally up to you. But what do you or did you do for work?
What did I do for work? Yep. For many, many years, I was a movie producer, and I lived in the United States. And lived in both Los Angeles and then in San Francisco, and produced a number of different movies, some very big, some small. And I also got involved in television and did some television series and television production as well. And then when I moved to Canada, I took a job working at the CBC. And I was in charge of television entertainment, and I wasn't a producer anymore. Now I was a network executive. And these days, I'm more or less retired, and I spend most of my time on volunteer projects. And the current one is been to buy and restore a beautiful old movie theater in Hamilton that will soon be opening and will be operating as an independent art house theater.
That movie theater, I think I had been to it before it closed. Mm-hmm. Is it the one that's, what was the original?
It's right near McMaster University.
Yeah.
And it's called the Westdale Theater.
Yes, I saw The Lost City of Zed or Oz, that movie with Charlie Hunnam. A British actor up and coming. It was amazing being in there.
It's a beautiful theater. It was built in 1935, Art Deco style. It was one of 32 neighborhood theaters all through Hamilton. And unfortunately, one of the last ones left. And it was about to be torn down. And then we started a nonprofit charitable organization to buy it and restore it.
Amazing. Well, that's great. I mean, you're doing a lot of good for the world of cinema and just, I guess, for the city.
I hope so. Some of it is altruistic. Yeah. Some of it is selfish because I love going to the movies.
Yeah,
and
true.
There's no good place to see good independent films or foreign films in Hamilton.
Yeah.
And it's 5 minutes from my house.
So that's probably the best part.
That's probably exactly.
So I got a bit of a strange question for you, but there recently in the news, there was someone, I forget the position, but someone in government who was Native American who had to swear their allegiance to the Queen before taking their position of power, and they said they couldn't do it, so they had to step down. It was very controversial, and with that, mm-hmm. I am wondering, have you ever, or becoming a citizen of Canada, did you have to pledge allegiance to the Queen?
That's England? A good question. I did become a Canadian citizen about 15 years ago and went through the citizen, you know, exam and the ceremony. And I can't recall that the Queen's name ever came up.
Okay.
I don't believe it did, but it's possible.
Yeah, but that's interesting, yeah, because that's something I think of. I was born and raised in Canada, and at no point pledged allegiance to the Queen.
No, I don't know. I don't know the story you're talking about, but that sounds very unusual, but interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so on to the next question here. What would you consider to be, let's say, the craziest or most enduring part of being a film producer? I want to bring it back to that profession.
Well, I think one way of thinking about it is it's not really a job. It's a lifestyle. So yeah. When one wants to go into the entertainment business, and particularly being a producer, it really can be all-consuming in terms of just your life. And it's not a regular 9-to-5 job. It's very inconsistent at times in terms of how much money you make or not make, or how busy you are, and then you're not busy. And therefore, it's not for everyone. But it suited my temperament and the way I like to just be. And therefore, you know, when things are really busy and you're deeply involved, it just can be that kind of wonderful sense of immersion into it. When I first got into the film business when I was very young, people would ask me what it's like. And I'd say it felt like I'd run away and join the circus. So you're part of a family of a circus. And for me, that was great because I never was interested in sort of a civilian life and that kind of regular 9-to-5 and year after year and working for the same company your whole life. And so it suited my temperament very well.
Nice. Yeah, I think for better or worse, I'm semi-similar in that the year-after-year thing sort of gets to me, because I'm like a jack-of-all-trades. I've done probably too many jobs where it doesn't look good on a resume if you got like, you know, 10 to 20 applications there. So another question I have for you here. What would you say is the greatest joy out of, let's say, being a movie producer?
Well, the greatest joy out of being a movie producer for me was the creative experience. The idea that, of course, not any one person can make a movie. It takes a whole army of people and an army of creative people, writers and directors and designers and all sorts of artists. And the greatest reward for me was being involved in helping to organize all those people, getting them to all work together to create a single vision, a single story, and to bring that to life. And it's very rewarding because, of course, once the film or the TV show is finished, it's there for all time. So people can experience it that year, they can experience it 10 years later, I can watch things I did 30 years ago, they still exist. It's that work has been captured in a sense forever, and not every job allows you that reward of being able to look back and still see the things that you accomplished.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And so the The things that go into producing a film, it's a lot of scheduling, it's a lot of organization, right? Or what's the biggest?
Well, there are many different kinds of producers, right?
Yeah.
Different things. But for me, the most important role of the producer is helping to, again, sort of organize all of the creative talent. As a producer, you're not the artist, you're not the screenwriter, you're not the director, you're not the actor. Your job is to work with all the artists and to organize them and to help keep them focused and on task and on budget. And so I would say the greatest challenge is getting these very diverse and very kind of sometimes highly strung or slightly, you know, crazy artist types to all work together collaboratively.
Yeah, because I would say with, like, the idea that I have in my head, at least naively, about being a producer, it seems similar or, you know, very analogous to, like, other positions, like, let's say, working, like, an oil rig. There would be someone, cause I'm just thinking of what's the opposite of art. It's like, you know, as mechanical as it gets, there is a person who would organize.
Right. Well, a group project or a team. Management applies
to
film. Project management applies to many things: building a house, running an oil rig, anything where there's project management involved,
or just where there's projects.
The difference in project management in the film and television business is the product itself is something that its value is completely subjective. There is no inherent value. You can make a $500,000 film that people just love and adore and make lots of money, or you can make one for $50 million and nobody watches it and no one's interested. So there's that added challenge of, unlike making, you know, if the project is building a house, well, when you're done, it's a house, and the house has its inherent value. Or if you're producing oil, or you're making shoes, but with film and television, you know, product, you really, it's very hard to know, and I don't think anybody does know all the time what ultimately the audience will say. So it adds a certain kind of gambling, high wire kind of variables to the process that you don't see in every kind of project.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, everybody has definitely noticed that studios are getting into universes and things. They're trying to make it reliable in a way.
Why they do all the sequels and you know, because they assume that if they've done it once well and they do something just like that, they'll like it again. It's kind of like McDonald's hamburgers, right? So they make a McDonald's hamburger, and if people like it, then they make as many as they can and keep selling that same hamburger because they know people like it. But so there's certainly that part of the film and television business that's alive and well. And of course, then there are people who don't want to make McDonald's hamburgers, and there are people who don't want to eat McDonald's hamburgers. So there are also people who are constantly trying to do something new and different, and then hope that there's an audience that will like the new and different and not just want to eat McDonald's hamburgers all the time.
Yeah. Is there any particular, like, I would assume that you have a very wide range of, taste when it comes to film.
I like all sorts of films, different genres, and films from different nationalities and different countries. And I like a lot of different types of film. There are few genres I'm not a huge fan of. I'm not a huge fan of horror movies.
It's just
not my thing, though. You know, there's some very good horror movies that are made. But I really do appreciate lots of different kinds of films and TV, and especially when at the heart of the story, the filmmaker has something, you know, he's really trying to say, you know. and is expressing some kind of opinion or commenting in some way on the human condition and trying to provoke you as an audience to think about the story you've seen and maybe even how it relates to your own life. So, but that can happen in big budgets, small budgets, different genres. There's no limitation to where that can be.
That's true. Has there been anything off the top of your head, any film that has captured you?
You mean this year?
Either recently or maybe in the past, like maybe that inspired
you.
Well,
there are many great films in the past.
Yeah.
The film this year that I think is incredibly extraordinary, I think will probably win the Academy Award, is a film called Roma.
I still haven't seen it, but yeah.
Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón. And it's in Spanish, and it's in black and white. But regardless of those limitations that say, oh, this won't be commercial, I think the story he tells is a very universal story, and it's told in a very artistic and very stylistically interesting way. And I hope people see it. And I hope they see it in the movie theater. See, unfortunately, it was financed by Netflix. So Netflix is not all that interested in whether it does well in the movie theater or not. They're only giving it a very small release just to qualify for the Academy Awards. And then it'll be on Netflix by the end of December. And probably the majority of people will watch it at home on their TV, which is sort of tragic because that's not what the filmmaker intended.
Mm-hmm. And what film is supposed to be. I mean, obviously, teach their own, right? The same aspect of subjectivity when it comes to art. But mm-hmm. the at least originally, like Nickelodeon's and then until eventually what cinema's become, it's about, you know, people coming together and sharing
a
movie-going experience.
There is cinema. You know, yeah. Cinema was an experience, a art form, a style of experiencing film in a, you know, dark theater, dark cave, and it was larger than life.
Yeah.
Television is smaller than life and experienced in your living room, often with the lights on and people talking and other distractions. So there's nothing wrong with watching, you know, television, and there's nothing wrong with films and television shows made for television. It just really is what was the intention of the filmmaker when he made the film. And therefore, what is the experience for the audience that will align closest with what the director actually had planned?
Yeah, the intention.
So,
nice, that's not bad. Would you consider yourself a music guy at all, or is it mostly film and
well, I love music, and I certainly love music in film. Mm-hmm. And I think music, and even more importantly, sound, is very underrated in terms of how important it is as part of the filmmaking process. We're not always as conscious of the music and sound as we are of the visuals or the performance or the script. So in that respect, I pay a lot of attention to music, but in terms of my own, you know, listening to music for pleasure and casual listening to music, I have to say I'm not terribly up to date with modern music.
Oh,
and I listen mostly to music that I listened to, you know, 40, 50 years ago when I was in a point in my own life, 15 to 25 or so, where music was a really important in my life. And I listened to music all the time. And it really impacted, you know, the person I became. But since then, it doesn't have that kind. I mean, I listen to the radio in the car, but I don't go to a lot of concerts. I don't sit and just listen to music very often.
Yeah. But so, yeah, I think everybody is a product of their time, whether or not they realize it's happening. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I'm probably going to be that same way in 20, 30 years. I'll
still
maybe not understand
things.
The current music, but yeah, listen to the music I listen to.
I think it's very much a function of where you are in your own life when you're exposed to music and how it sort of becomes part of your memory and therefore it becomes aligned with a certain set of experiences you had at that time. And so whenever you hear that music, it sort of triggers those feelings and memory. And if this was a very, you know, important time in your life and a developmental time in your life, it's not unusual that people want to re-experience that again.
Yeah, because when do you think people slow down from changing? I mean, obviously that comes into joining
the workforce. Well, I think it's different for everybody. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason to it, but at least in terms of music and listening to music and going to concerts and things like that, that all requires a certain amount of free time, you know, unless it's your profession. So that's usually when you're more in high school or college or something like that. When you're busy, you know, trying to carve out a career, or you're busy having children or something, your free time diminishes quickly. And one of the things that generally goes is the ability to just sort of hang out and listen to music, because you just don't have the time anymore.
Yeah, that's true. It's unfortunate, but I mean, you're trading in one
thing.
Not for
everybody. Not for everybody. For some people, it's a very important part of their life, and they continue to do it their whole lives. So we're really generalizing here, but
the prioritization. Yeah, it's up to the individual, obviously, but for most of the time, I guess when you get older, it becomes, you know, more time, obviously, raising your children, yada, yada.
Work.
That's a good point. And work, yeah. Got to work to make a living. That's how the world works.
Hopefully you're working for more than just make a living.
That would be the ideal, obviously, yeah. At least getting a bit of passion in there. Yeah, okay. So I got a lot of general questions here that, you know, well, some of them maybe are a little too general. Like, you know, what was your childhood like?
That's an easy question. Because, you know, I don't think my childhood was that unusual. I mean, I grew up in New York. I grew up on Long Island. My parents were fairly stable and around. And mom and dad, my father was a university professor. I had two sisters and a brother, and we didn't move around a lot. We were I pretty much grew up in one place from the time I was 2 till the time I was 18. And so I was quite fortunate that I didn't have a lot of large upheavals or, you know, I didn't have any horrible physical or medical problem in my childhood. I didn't suffer from any type of, you know, again, economic stress. So certainly when I hear a lot of people's stories, I feel very fortunate that I lived a relatively, stable life for my childhood years. Yeah, so I was very blessed.
That's good. So it was very stable for you. You didn't move, but then when you turned 18,
then it all changed. Then I moved a lot. But
that was just by yourself.
Then when I got married too, because I went to school in Connecticut, and then my parents had moved to California.
They moved to
the San Francisco area for a while. I lived in Los Angeles. I got married living in Los Angeles. I moved to there many years, went to San Francisco area many years, moved to Toronto, lived there many years. Now I live out in Dundas. So I would say for my children, they did not have that same stable existence in a single town with a single set of friends. They really kept being moved around, and it was just a very different experience for them.
Yeah. But they turned out okay. I mean, you know.
Everybody turns out okay. We all have our own paths.
Yeah,
we all have our own experiences. I think it's almost impossible to even say that turned out okay, because that implies some kind of a judgment of what okay means, right?
Yeah.
And the reality is, at least I believe, that nobody knows that. We have no idea what contracts we have. We have no idea why we're here and what type of experiences and lessons we're here to learn. And I certainly recognize that it was during the most difficult times in my life that I actually learned the most and grew the most. So one would be, you know, be foolish to think that just having horrible things happen to you or bad times in your life is a bad thing, because it's not. You know, it's not.
It's squeezing the coal to bring out the diamond.
Well, we just don't know. I mean, but we're here, you know, again, I believe we're here to experience life and to learn. And again, you can't have hot without cold. You can't have light without dark, you know.
Yeah.
We live in a universe of duality, or at least, you know, this, you know, 3D reality we live in is based on duality. And so I think the biggest mistake anyone can make is to try to judge other people's lives or even to judge your own life and to think that you know what
constitutes
supposed to happen
and
in any way try to deny any of the negative feelings or bad feelings or bad experiences, because that's just what it is, you know.
Yeah, everything's relative to each person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So actually that brings up a good question.
Okay.
I got for you, which is what is your general philosophy? Are you someone who believes in destiny or ghosts or anything like that? What would you say?
I don't believe in destiny per se. I mean, I believe in karma. You know,
yeah.
I believe that we are souls. I believe in reincarnation. I believe that there is a higher self or soul, that we do, you know, we are, there is there are multiple experiences we have on planet Earth and other places as well, and it's all part of the experience, the learning, the evolution of one's, you know, self, and that, you know, we came from oneness and we will return to oneness, but for this brief moment we're here, you know, incarnated in a physical body as a human being, experiencing, you know, all of the beauty and joy of Earth, experiencing other souls who we may or may not actually have had contracts that we created with them before we even incarnated. I'm absolutely convinced that children pick their parents.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Choose the parents they want to come to, because those parents are going to provide the opportunity for that soul to learn and grow and learn the lessons that they need to learn. And I believe that there probably are soul flames that we may indeed have another soul that we have a deeper connection to and reincarnate at times together and find each other again, and sometimes not, you know. I don't think there's any, you know, any strict rules about this. But so again, you know, with that type of philosophy, it means that you really should be living your life in appreciation of all the experiences you have. And death is certainly not the end of anything. It's just, you know, passing on
into a
different existence, you know, into a different sense of existence. So I think that's kind of been an influence or a way of thinking about my own life that probably has allowed me to be a little more risk-taking, perhaps a little more open to change, a little less fearful as to what outside things could happen to me that would make me unhappy or kind of, make me depressed, because, you know, it's an appreciation for, you know, the relative nature of what this particular human existence is.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to put it. It's very wise. Because for me, obviously I'm still young, right? But I dove into philosophy as soon as I understood what it was like in high school. And yeah, with the concept of reincarnation, because I'm big into science, right? Like physics and everything. So that's the stable ground that I have. But other than that, I'm completely up in the air and open-minded just about what we don't know.
Well, what you know, science is now is leading the way in terms of spirituality, particularly with quantum mechanics and quantum physics, because what science now tells us is that it is all relative, that reality is simply what you're perceiving. There's no fixed sense of reality. It's the observer who creates the subject.
Which it gives credence to the multiverse, because they say...
Exactly. So that's the whole point, is that there is a multiverse, because this isn't the one and only reality there is. So as science proves what, you know, spiritual teachers have been saying since the dawn of time, it's quite interesting, because I believe that the scientists, in a sense, have become and will continue to become the spiritual leaders of human evolution, you know. And as we start to open up even more extraordinary opportunities and experiences of other dimensions, or be it time travel, or, you know, really start to unwind the old physics of 3D reality, it's going to change the way people feel about and think about their lives, right? So it's going to be a very exciting time.
Whenever that is. There's a lot of people saying because of the exponential growth that technology has given us, a lot of people are scared of AI, and we could get into that subject, but for the sake of where I'm going to take this, we have wants and needs because of how we developed through evolution, right? It's like there's sex, food, sleep, all that
survival.
Kind of stuff.
Survival.
Yeah. So a lot of people are scared that AI will try to take over the world, but the real thing to wonder is why would it, if it doesn't have the same sort of biochemistry that we have? So I figure AI isn't really anything to worry about, and with it, we might actually find some sort of singularity.
Well, I do believe in the singularity, and I believe it's real, and it's just a question of, to the extent it's going to change or dominate 3D reality as we know it today, is the question. And of course, the idea of human evolution, well, you're absolutely right. So many of the aspects of our human condition are no longer really serving us.
No.
The idea of having to, you know, fight and flight and fight for survival. Now, there are still many people on the planet who have to fight for survival, but there are lots of people who don't anymore, but they still operate as if they do. And that's kind of, you know, a vestige of where we're coming from. Where we're going to, it's very hard to define, because again, you know, the fear can be that things will be different. They will be different. They won't be the same. So if you're fearful of anything changing because you think we've reached some perfect status of human evolution, that I think that's kind of foolish, because it will change no matter how hard you try to hang on to it, you know. So my theory is there is really nothing to be fearful of at all. And that one really is best embracing the reality of change.
Yeah, very well put. Yeah. And so this is a side note, but just to bring back to the concept of reincarnation, because that's another one that I've thought a lot about. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I do this, but I like to theorize my own things that probably hopefully make sense, because I'd like to think that I'm above average when it comes to logic and like bringing things to conclusions through fields of thought. And when I think of reincarnation and the concept of a soul, so maybe not even reincarnation, but the Christian idea or just any concept where there's this thing that isn't like a physical part of the brain. As far as quantum physics go, it's clear that the closer you look, the fuzzier it gets, and things are just indeterminate until you look at them. And so the concept of there being this thing, like whether it's a fire, a ball, or an orb or something, like a lot of people think it might be that as far as the paranormal goes, whether like souls or these orbs, or it does, you know, maybe doesn't even have a physical shape.
Physical representation of it.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's sort of...
That's not the point.
That's not the point.
Yeah.
But there is something that I don't think you can deny or any individual can deny, and it's called consciousness.
Yeah, that's the ultimate mystery.
Yeah, the science has no idea what creates consciousness.
Yeah.
They look at the brain, they can't tell. They don't know why it exists, and they don't know why it stops. You know, the physical body stops, but why does consciousness stop? Or maybe it doesn't stop. So it's very hard when I talk to people who don't believe at all in a soul or reincarnation or anything else, because I don't think consciousness is an accident. I don't think
we're self-aware. I mean, the idea is impossible.
It didn't happen just out of a bunch of strange coincidental synapses going on in the brain.
And then just
because it's actually more than synapses in the brain. That's the whole point. So you're right. I mean, some people don't believe that at all, and they don't believe in any of this. But I find it hard, because if you do believe that you're a conscious person, then you have to ask yourself, well, where did that come from?
Yeah, the who, what, when, where, why, how kind of scenario. Because I think the two merge with the whole people fearing change and people just being certain about something or another. Like, we can't be certain about the things we don't have answers for. All we can do is theorize.
I don't think we can be certain about anything.
Yeah.
You know, the existence of this couch is, you know, I mean, this is all only here because our consciousness and our perception has been able to create these forms, you know, and define forms and define a way of describing the form. But other people with other awarenesses and other consciousness wouldn't see it the same way or think about color or things like that.
Yeah,
color. So I find it very scary, to me at least, when people feel like they have this need to define everything, to judge everything, to be able to give it some kind of fixed, concrete understanding. And I just believe the universe is far more fluid than that and is in this constant motion, constant change.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know, but there's certainly a lot of people out there who don't want to hear or think about any of this. And mostly it's because of fear.
Because I try to think about why, like, certain things happen like that. I mean, I didn't get into psychology or anything, but when it comes to evolutionary psychology, a lot of stuff is very clear. But when you start to get more narrow, like with fear, a fear of the unknown, as far as like the visual unknown, that makes sense. Because if you're in a dark cave and you don't know if there's like a mountain lion outside, that makes sense.
Yeah, well,
but when people are afraid,
man had good reasons to be fearful.
Afraid of the dark.
Survival was a problem.
That was the number one.
Yeah. We don't have that problem anymore.
Yeah.
90% of the human beings, certainly in North America, are not worrying about survival. Really, don't have to worry that they're going to starve to death or not have shelter. So then it's not survival anymore. It's something else.
Yeah, our brain still has to operate a certain way, so people find other things to...
I think that's what unfortunately happens, is that we have these vestiges of and memories that are perhaps even in cellular memories that limit our thinking, because we're still in that kind of reactive mode that really is no longer serving a purpose anymore. I think that's what nationalism is.
Tribalism, nationalism.
Tribal nationalism. I don't really see that it has a lot of purpose or doing a lot of good for people anymore. And one could say probably the same thing about organized religion. Organized religion has probably done more harm than good on this planet, And I think that you're going to see that come to an end soon.
A lot of people say the original reason for it was control, of course, because there is a hierarchical system to it, whether it's shaman or,
I would say it was survival, because the very earliest shamanistic sort of tribal religions, the religion served the purpose of creating culture and creating ways of passing down knowledge and information that helped the tribe survive.
Yeah.
Right, so it actually had a survival purpose to it, and then it just has kind of just grown and grown and then twisted and twisted, and it sort of lost what its original purpose was. But yeah, I mean, it's now it's used, and of course that, you know, particularly the geniuses who figured out how to take Jesus's teachings and turn them
into
the purpose of controlling these foreign populations that they were defeating.
That was Constantine, I'm pretty sure.
And the Romans.
Legalized Christianity.
But there have been other examples. I'm not saying this is the only one, but this is one that certainly for the last 2,000 years has sort of dominated this planet.
Well, think about it. What year is it right now? That's like the ultimate example of, you know, how the world is dominated.
What?
It's the year 2018.
They made up a calendar.
Yeah, exactly. And even the occupation in both instances was a Christian crusade, wasn't it? The Spanish Inquisition and then the English.
Well, the Spanish Inquisition was driven by Catholicism.
Yeah.
But when you mean English imperialism, in terms of their conquering and spreading their teaching around the world, that was more economic than it was religious per se. But certainly there have been, you know, all kinds of Christian missionaries and other things. Certainly the conquest of America and the domination of the Indian population, both here and in South America, was driven by religion, and the early missionaries.
And the Canadian Notre Dame in Montreal, mm-hmm. I went there, I'm going to say it was 2 years ago now, and me and my friends went, and so we were doing a tour, so we had someone explaining to us all of the stained glass portraits and the story they're telling about this guy who climbed Mont Royal Mountain, and with a cross, because he was trying to reenact what Jesus did.
Early explorers,
and the images on the stained glass was literally them, like, holding down, like, a Native American by the neck with their boot, like, showing them the Bible, and they're like, these brave French people brought them Jesus, and it's like, what are you talking about? When you look at that, it's like they called them savages, and yet the French are doing that.
Very sad. They really had a worldview that these were not people; that they were of almost a different species or something, and that they were really. And I really do believe that a lot of them actually believe this, that. That these heathens would never go to heaven because they didn't embrace Christ, and that they were actually performing a valuable mission by bringing these teachings to these heathens. It's almost inconceivable, but the dogma of the church was so powerful, and these people were so indoctrinated in it from the time they were, you know, 2 years
little
old.
Babies.
And they never heard anything else. There was no freedom of speech. There were no other opinions being expressed.
It was pretty science.
It was very difficult to understand. I mean, it's very hard for us to understand today how they thought that way, but I don't think they were necessarily horrible, evil people. This is just all
their worldview.
That's all they knew.
And actually, to make this topical, I don't know if you heard, but there was an American who went to this forbidden island off of India to try and spread Jesus, and he was killed. And then the people who sent him there also were arrested because they knew it was illegal. It was like, you know, some black market boaters that sent him there.
This is an isolated community that we should allow them to continue to live the way they want to.
That's what they
want
to do, yeah.
And it's very sad. He may have been very well-intentioned, but clearly...
The thing behind that, so yeah, clearly he was well-intentioned in his own mind about what he was doing, but he had known about this island apparently since he was a teenager.
Right.
So it was like his life's goal to go there, even though we heard about all the people who were killed that went there. And yeah, some people are, it's complete delusion to think that, you know, they have this aura around them.
But it's what they're taught. It comes from somewhere. They don't wake up one morning and decide, oh, I'm going to go do this.
Yeah.
It's part of an indoctrination that sets up a series of beliefs that this kind of behavior and action is appropriate.
But I mean, you know, I guess it's a good thing that we live in a world where there's something like TED Talks, ideas worth spreading, and, you know.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think, you know, the concept of democracy is a kind of a good idea, but freedom of speech is kind of a good idea. And yeah, I think we are lucky that there are ways that different opinions can be expressed now and dialogue can be had. Certainly it's a lot better than it was 500 years ago, but
yeah,
there's still a lot of challenges.
That's true. Because, yeah, there's side effects, like the rise of flat earth theorists have come back.
Well, again, in the world we live in today, which allows just about anyone to become a pundit and express their opinions and be able to talk to mass audiences through the internet, you're going to get a lot of diverse and extremists
ideas.
And opinions and extreme ideas and these kinds of niche groups. And it's just the nature of the beast. And I don't see it as being bad or good. It's really just where we are today.
Yeah, it just happens. It's the same.
But we still restrict so much of the evolution of mankind based on our sort of very limited perception of how people are supposed to live and what life is supposed to be. Like a perfect example to me is the fact that the powers that be have decided to limit consciousness. They are absolutely determined that there's only one good form of consciousness, which is sort of the Protestant mentality of be focused, be productive, work hard, blah, blah, blah. You know, in many civilizations, the people who were worshipped and thought to be the most important people of the tribe were the dreamers, were the people who had visions or who lived in the woods as monks. Or, now if you call somebody a dreamer, you're insulting them. And they used to be considered the most important people in the civilization. And the fact that we control the use of any kind of drugs to explore consciousness, and LSD is illegal, and ayahuasca is illegal, and peyote is illegal.
And it's true. It is tragic.
That's like insane, right?
Yeah.
Because these are all different ways that one can explore consciousness. And if you think, what else is human? Are we here to do as human beings? You would think exploring consciousness, what it is, where does it come from, what does it mean to be conscious, would be a very important thing for humans to be exploring. But our society has absolutely said, no way. There's only one kind of consciousness you're allowed. This is the way you have to think. And this is, if you want to be part of our society.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Because I think the only place where it's acceptable, and even then, I'm not sure how many facilities like this exist, but there is end-of-life therapy that uses LSD. That might just be an experimental.
I don't know if it's legal, and I don't know where. There might be some countries that it might be legal. I'm not sure. Now, obviously, there are other civilizations in the jungle in South America and other places where the use of these kinds of mind, consciousness raising or consciousness changing, it is legal and it's been going on for thousands of years. It's nothing new, but I'm talking about Western civilization.
Yeah.
It's not a whole lot. I mean, look at the challenges just even around, THC, which is not really an hallucinogenic or consciousness altering drug. And the fear, the huge fear of allowing that to be legalized, and now the impact of it being legalized, it's demonstrative of a real fear on some level that we have to maintain at all costs this one way of thinking about life and life's experiences.
Yeah, and so I know someone close to me who has, she's completely against any sort of mind-altering thing except for alcohol. She's against weed because it gives
why
anxiety.
Is alcohol different?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a societal thing. One thing that she says is the fear is that what if she took magic mushrooms,
right.
Got to this very unstable state.
Correct.
Where, like, you can't go buy groceries when you're, you know, in that state.
That's right. So don't buy groceries.
Yeah, but she's afraid that she'll take it and then never come back.
Well, that's right. The fear is that if your consciousness shifts and becomes aware of other aspects of existence and perceives one's own persona and person in a different way, that you won't be the same person anymore. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, but it's still nothing to fear.
But in my mind, it's nothing to fear because there's nothing that it can be that it's not. Now, there are some people who believe, of course, in evil. And they believe that evil exists. And evil is an energy in the same way good is an energy or God is an energy. And there are certain dangers of if your psyche is sort of weakened or in a vulnerable state, that evil can actually filter in and do harm. And this is, for me, Joe, is the hardest one. I kind of get it. I kind of understand it's true that there's somewhere that exists. I've never experienced it. I don't know why it exists or what its purpose would be, but it does exist. There is dark energy as well. And that's, for me, the biggest challenging part. So when you talk about this idea of consciousness and altering consciousness, that's the one part I can't quite reconcile with, that there is that possibility that this kind of a dark or evil energy, you may be more susceptible to allowing that to impact you. But from my perception, that's what alcohol does.
Yeah, specifically whiskey. That's the killer.
That's what alcohol does. So alcohol alters your consciousness and allows, and people say, oh, I never would have said that, except I was drunk, or I never did that, was drunk. That somehow, again, because of this drug in your system that's affected your consciousness, it's allowing some evil or dark energy, which may be already inside you, by the way. It may not be external at all. So it may just be allowing something that's in you already to reveal itself. I've heard other people talk that way, but I think it's hypocritical that they're still happy to go out and get drunk. Yeah. Makes no sense. Why is that different than anything else?
Yeah, exactly.
I just can't figure that out.
Yeah. As far as evil goes, I'm pretty sure the concept of evil for me is just that certain things just developed in a certain way. So there's no, like, I don't think the evolution of predator and prey was on purpose or intentional. I just think that just so happened to happen because you can get food from things that aren't just plants. Mm-hmm. So that developed into us and, like, chimpanzees and other primates that share the similar genome to us. Mm-hmm. So because there is a predator-prey mentality that human beings have, like, we can be both. We're very homogenous. Like, we're very omni-influential with our instincts. So there's some people who are more predisposed to have, for their inhibition, when it gets lowered, to have this darker side of them where they're more sadistic.
I generally think it has to do with their conditioning more than anything else.
Yes, it's the backpedaling.
And then in some way mimicking behavior they've observed either from their father or someone else in their society versus something that is innate. My question, of course, is there this other thing that is not that, that is actually innately evil, innately dark, and is an energy that is part of the universe, and that I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. That's to me unknown, because that concept, because people who are like totally innocent, nice people who then get possessed, because there's the movie like The Exorcism of Emily Rose, that kind of stuff. It could be that they had schizophrenia yeah, in their brain that gets unlocked at a certain age,
already,
or it could it have actually been external.
Come from some external?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think
currently it's unanswerable. It's a big question. So we are closing in. Great. We got 5 minutes left.
Sure.
I love this whole conversation, but to change the tune as we enter the outro, I'll throw some opinion topics at you.
Please.
And see which ones land.
Okay.
So what is your opinion on Ouija boards? Have you ever done one before?
No, I believe they exist. Yeah, I mean,
and they have
Ouija
a power.
Boards are a way of trying to connect with spirit. Yes, I do believe they exist and that they're real.
What is your opinion on dreaming?
Well, dreaming is another form of consciousness. It's when our consciousness relaxes and we're able to experience other energy and thought and worlds and life. And it's a very, very important part of human existence.
And
I think everyone should pay very close attention to their dreams. They're all metaphors. Nothing is real, is as realistic as, you know, don't take anything literally from your dreams, because it's usually more symbolic. I think they're very important.
Yeah. And to that point, they say when you dream, your body paralyzes itself. It uses a certain natural chemical that, like, that's why people who don't have the chemical sleepwalk and stuff. And there's this other chemical called dimethyltryptamine, which is DMT, which is like the spirit molecule, a lot of people call it, that exists in the Amazon.
Well, that's the active ingredient in ayahuasca.
Oh, in ayahuasca too, yeah.
It's DMT.
And a lot of people say that's, you know, that is something that everybody should experience at least once, even if it is closer
well,
to death.
Well, we actually have DMT in our natural chemistry.
Yeah, that's
we,
what I'm saying.
We
when
generate
dream,
DMT, and it's real and it exists, and it's natural. And certainly that's an example of, because back in the 60s, there was experimentation going on with DMT. And consciousness and the impact of DMT and consciousness and different things like that.
Well, wasn't that the love revolution, or what did they call it?
Well, there was a lot of different. I mean, this was science.
Yeah.
You know, scientists. But for sure, I don't know. I mean, again, it really depends on the people and who you are. But what people get confused about is the difference between taking and using drugs or hallucinogenics recreationally versus actually using them in some type of ceremony or guided or therapeutic way, because those are completely different situations, right?
Yeah.
And there is a huge problem when people think that these are ways of having recreational fun, because this is serious shit. It's not about recreational fun. It's work.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
On to the next one.
Sure.
What is your opinion on social media?
Well, I mean, social media is real. It exists. It's a phenomenon that's pretty much transformed most people's experiences, at least in Western civilization, and certainly the children and everything else. And I think there's a lot of good, you know, that's come of it, and ways people can communicate, and ways we can hear opinions and express ourselves and create community and do lots of wonderful stuff. I think there's a downside that worries me at times because of the fact that it's sort of virtual. It's not something that is a physical experience of community or a way in which people interact in a physical way with each other. And I do worry sometimes that people could obviously, you know, this could become the dominant way in which they experience the world and experience life. It's like virtual reality and it's like video games, you know? I mean, you know, people could very well in the future spend a majority of their waking existence in an artificial world and not in the real world. Is that a bad thing? I guess so. I'm not 100% sure it is, you know, because again, from my perception, the real world is an illusion. You know, this is just as much as an illusion as the video game world that people live in. So maybe there's actually some good that'll come out of it, because maybe people will start to recognize that the nature of what we call reality maybe isn't that different. You
know? Yeah. Well, I think that's a great point to end it on.
Okay. Good.
But as we say goodbye to the audience and also each other, are there any parting words of wisdom that you might want to encapsulate? Live, laugh, love, anything like that?
As I said, the only thing that I think are the constants in our lives are love and change. And the more you can embrace those two energies, the more aligned you'll be with the flow of your life, and certainly there's not much to fear.
Great.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Joe. That was fun.